The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
If you're following along in your study outline, we're coming now to Roman numeral 6 on that outline and the topic of the culture of poverty. I'd encourage you, just as a side note here, as you can see from the study guide, there are journal articles assigned, and I think you'll want to take a look fairly early at this stage to the fine essay by Viv Grigg, which is included in the back of your study guide. You'll also get, I think, a great deal of help in the discussions in John Palin's book on the urban world, if you haven't come to that as yet. We want to touch, first of all, on the history of the discussion, and that history revolves specifically around the name of Oscar Lewis. Lewis's name should be fairly familiar to most of you by now. It's popped up more than once in our earlier studies. Lewis was one of the very first anthropologists to shift his attention from peasant village studies, which dominated so many discussions earlier on in the century, to the struggles of urban adaptive techniques. We've already noted a few lectures back his response to Robert Redfield and to the notion that the city destroys the individual, the family, and the social order. Lewis was what some people have called a biographical anthropologist. Much of his writing, and fascinating material it is, focused on the life of a family. Probably the book that has he's most famous for is the title The Children of Sanchez. In 1959, he published, for example, the book Five Families. It was an ethnobiography of five resident families in Mexico City, and here he began the formulation of a concept that came to be associated with him, the concept of the culture of poverty. Living in poverty, he argued, was not just a condition of economic deprivation or personal social disorientation. Poverty, he was stressing, was a culture, a way of life. As a culture, poverty possessed strategies, defense mechanisms created by the poor through which the poor rationalized their existence. So as a culture, he was arguing, it exhibited considerable stability, and also as a culture, it was passed down through family lines from one generation to the next. As a culture also, Lewis was arguing, it developed a system of values and patterns of human behavior. A culture of poverty, in other words, was developed to provide a way of human coping with the reality and the degrading character of vast want and human need. And once that culture came into existence, like all cultures, it tended to be perpetuated through time, regardless of changes in the circumstances of the people. Like all cultures and subcultures, it is transmitted intergenerationally. So, says Lewis, by the time a child is 6 or 7, he or she has been irreversibly molded into the culture of poverty. Now, that in the simplest lines was Lewis's argument, and it was certainly enough to create a great deal of controversy. Maybe violent would be a good word to use here. In fact, a violent debate still continues over this thesis of Lewis. Some of the debate is very substantive, with authors attacking the very notion of the culture of poverty at its core. other debates dealing with more with just my corrective additions. One of the earliest responses, and one of the most significant, came in 1968 from the press of the University of Chicago and from the pen of Dr. Charles Valentine. The book was called Culture and Poverty, Critique and Counterproposals. In the book, Valentine challenged the idea of a self-perpetuating subculture of poverty associated with the lower class or the underclass. Poverty, Valentine said, is a condition resulting from the inequities of the social system. The characteristics and habits of the poor were a function of their condition. Said Valentine, the culture of poverty seems to imply that the problem lay in changing the habits of the deprived and oppressed. By contrast, Valentine said, hey, it lays in changing the system by reducing inequalities, beginning with unrestricted access to wealth, to jobs, to education. In other words, those processes of integration and habituation that shape individual purposes and characters. Valentine's problem, or some of the his work has its own problems. He's charged very often with not adequately dealing, for example, with the process of enculturation. His theory of situational disorganization, I think, has problems. Seems to imply, say some critics of Valentine, that the habits and conditionings which people exhibited were experiential adaptations to their circumstances. So as circumstances changed, they would readily readapt their behavior to the requirements of social living. And this kind of argument by Valentine then ignores the whole process of enculturation, where in this process, habituative and integrative processes shape individual purposes and character. Another source of criticism on the culture of poverty, probably far less extreme than Valentine, comes from the book The Anthropology of the City, written by two authors, William Eames, E-A-M-E-S, and Judith Good, G-O-O-D-E. In their book, The Anthropology of the City, the last, and it's an earlier title, the last chapter deals with the question of the culture of poverty. And Eames and Good offer what sound to me like several good questions or comments made. I'd prefer, in a sense, to call them correctives more than criticisms, but at any rate, here they are. Their questions. First one, by way of correction, what is urban about the culture of poverty? Poverty, after all, they point out, is not an exclusively urban phenomenon, nor, as a matter of fact, is it generated simply by the cities. Poverty, racism, sexism, for example, they're arguing, are fundamental characteristics of the larger social system. And so they turn to Oscar Lewis and fault him for really carrying out his poverty research exclusively in urban areas. He had selected for his participant observation a slum community. And the Eames and Good are pointing out that his selection of this very community gives the concept an urban appearance. That criticism, to my mind, seems fairly valid. But at the same time, I think we need to remind ourselves that poverty still remains a characteristic of urban life and it needs treatment. Secondly, Eames and Good also comment that Oscar Lewis apparently accepts early childhood cultural transmission as the only significant enculturation process. However, they point out that recent scholarship is re-examining this sort of previously kind of fundamental axiom of anthropology, and studies are now focusing on determining when early socialization is important, when it's not. That point also, I think, is well taken. A third, respond evens and good to the Lewis thesis. This thesis also, they claim, substantially alters the anthropological notion of culture. Eames and Good point out in this connection that two notions of culture are now sort of current, floating through the literature. There is the what they call the cognitive model, and there is the ecological model. The cognitive model of culture, they're arguing, defines culture as a system of cognitive categories or cognitive maps, which people carry around in their heads and then transmit through symbolic codes, words, etc., literature, buildings, art forms, whatever. Then there's the ecological model. This defines culture as a set of adaptive strategies for survival. They're usually linked to a particular setting of available resources, external constraints. Eames and Good argue that Lewis comes closest to the cognitive model. However, the current cognitive model, they continue, sees the issue of change as fundamental. And this is precisely where Lewis's ideas fail. His idea of culture, they insist, is built on the assumption that those in the culture of poverty are relatively immune from changes in the system. So Lewis, as they interpret him, sees the culture of poverty as relatively self-perpetuating and closed to outside influences. Now this, as I read it, is also legitimate criticism. But I also feel this is a modification, and it can be built into the Lewis models, and the basic ideas can be that Lewis is proposing can be amplified without destroying the whole concept. And I guess also, before I leave Eames and Good, I'd also question myself the assumption of Eames and Good's view of culture that leaves out the transforming aspect of religious faith as a key factor in change. In other words, cultural mobility is not primarily a cognitive or even an ecological question of balance. Cultural mobility is a question of worldview change, and that means it's a question of religious commitment. Now, the strongest criticism of the culture of poverty has come from those who say, in opposition to Lewis's argument, that the cause of poverty is not the poor themselves. This group of scholars argue that the cause of poverty is the systemic limitation of opportunity imposed by a wider society. And probably the strongest representative of this criticism is William Ryan, R-Y-A-N, and his book, Blaming the Victim. The book was published by Vintage in 1971, paperback, still in print, and one that most certainly those of you listening to these tapes ought to have eventually. Ryan, for example, argues that virtually all of society's wealth, prestige, power are controlled by those in higher positions in the social stratification hierarchy. So as a result, says Ryan, the poor have none of the most effective resources for controlling their own future or present. Without money, without power, the poor cannot insist on quality schooling for their children. Given inadequate training, says Ryan, they cannot compete equally for jobs. And if we add to these factors racial, ethnic barriers, the minority poor find themselves literally trapped. Now, at this point, says Ryan, the wealthy of a society make it seem like the person on the bottom is responsible for his or her being on the bottom. They tend to focus, Ryan's book argues, on these problems as they seem to trace the responsibility for these problems back to the poor. They focus on the faults of the poor, hence the title Blaming the Victim. This absolves the rich from recognizing their own complicity. If the poor created their poverty, they should do something about it. And this whole rationale, Ryan calls blaming the victim. So by using it, members of higher classes perpetuate their own social advantage. And he argues that Lewis has done this also by speaking of a culture of poverty. Are the poor unmotivated, as Lewis seems to claim? Well, studies show that poor urbanites also have ambitions and hopes and dreams and plans. The Spates and Massionis book, page 409 and following, deals with this whole topic. Now, once again, I concur in this criticism of Lewis's work. I think Ryan's made a good point. And I also feel, I guess, that this whole process of blaming the victim is a very prominent theme in evangelical thinking about the poor. I don't know how many meetings I've been to where people respond to discussions on the Bible and the poor by saying, well, they're poor because they're lazy or they're indifferent. And then we get a quote from 1 Thessalonians, "He who does not work should not eat." Seems to me the biblical picture is much more balanced, and we don't have time to go into that now. My perception is that really only in the book of Proverbs is laziness and indifference cited as a major reason for poverty. The preponderant material, particularly in the Old Testament and the Psalms, emphasizes the poor as the objects of oppression, the objects of indifference on the part of the rich. And I'd encourage you to just take the time to work through some of this material yourself. Get out a good Bible concordance and look up words like poor, humble, meek, and take a look at this study. In summary, then, I do not find these criticisms as really totally destructive of Oscar Lewis's thesis. I think they serve better as correctives to his work. In other words, there is a culture of poverty given these correctives and comments. And what can we now say about it, and say of a positive sort? Let's deal, so very quickly, with some of the characteristics of the culture of poverty. Speaking first, for example, about its origins. In industrial settings, the culture of poverty is an urban paradox. People move to the city for economic gain. We've talked about this in connection with migration. And yet the city is characterized by the growth of mass poverty. The culture then forms and develops in the site of the sort of what I guess you might call the golden ghettos. But mobility up seems impossible. People seem to adapt to poverty then in a total way. Remember, though, even as we say this and talk about origins, the culture of poverty is not equal to being poor, and Lewis also argues for this. The poor often improve their situations. They're upwardly mobile. Their values are essentially mainstream society. However, the people in the culture of poverty have adopted their culture and the mainstream value system into strategies for survival. So even when roads or houses or jobs start coming into the ghetto neighborhoods of the third world or our cities in the U.S., the culture of poverty remains. People don't keep at their jobs. Houses deteriorate. They do not accept the values of the dominant society. Remember also, as we talk about origins, that the culture of poverty commonly develops in a number of settings. The urban link is really only one possible factor in this whole question, only one of those settings. That culture develops when a stratified social economic system is breaking down or is being replaced by another. And a sample, I think, would be going back in history, the time of rapid transition from feudalism in Europe to capitalism. Another more familiar to us, I think, from the literature you've probably been reading would be during the Industrial Revolution. Sometimes it results from imperial conquest in which the conquered are sort of maintained in kind of a servile status, and that may continue for generations. I think from this point of view, we could speak of a culture of poverty in Latin America since the coming of the conquistador. Cities which I sense which have grown up in the colonial era are also exemplify this reason. Cities associated with the colonial conquerors, because of that very element of conquest and marginalization, will demonstrate this. And it can also occur, for example, in the process of migration. Sometimes this is called, I think, detribalization. Places like Africa would exhibit this. Here the tribal migrants to the cities develop what one author has called courtyard cultures. Often appears in cash economies with high rates of unemployment or underemployment. I think that's in the last decade or so in the United States. The growth of the use of the term underemployed, the underclass, I think points probably to this as one of the settings out of which a culture of poverty is formed. I think all of this is really important in correcting the thinking, the notion that the culture of poverty is only a temporary or a sort of a transitional state that you move through in your progress from the rural to the urban life. This usually is associated with our connections, I think, of the culture of poverty with slum conditions of the city. I remind you that, as does Lewis and others, the culture of poverty often persists in stable social systems. Now, we mentioned the origins of the culture of poverty. Let me touch on a few more of its characteristics. Out of these origins, in the second place, comes the disengagement, the non-integration of the poor with respect to the major institutions of society. Poverty, segregation, discrimination, fear, suspicion, apathy, sort of all these things combine, all or some of them, combine to set people apart from the dominant culture. They don't belong to labor unions. They don't belong to political parties. They make very little use of banks, hospitals, department stores, museums. Such involvement as there is usually in the institutions of the larger society, the armies, public welfare systems, prisons. This does little to suppress the traits of the culture of poverty. And in this process, people develop their own counter-institutions, and this is the real system to which members of this culture poverty go and into which they fit. But this real system perpetuates rather than eliminates poverty, and often it's built on the pervading sense of just hopelessness. A third point. In the culture of poverty, and one of the characteristics or features you look for in the culture of poverty, people produce little wealth and receive little in return. There's chronic employment, unemployment, underemployment, lack of savings, shortage of cash. And this imprisons the family in a very vicious circle. There's a high incidence of pawning of goods, borrowing at usurious rates of interest, informal credit from neighbors, frequent purchases of small quantities of food at higher prices. And out of this, they build a cultural concept of time, a concept that is not past-oriented but is present-oriented and not future. Virtually little place for a past or a future. Mañana, in Latin America and Spanish, is not a hopeful concept for the poor. Number four, with poor housing, there is also gregariousness of a high sort. There's a minimum of organization beyond the nuclear and extended family. There's a low level of organization. This makes it impossible to mobilize to get things done for the for this subculture. And the end result is to give the poor a marginal and anomalous quality in a very highly organized society. Nobody speaks for the poor. Number five, quickly. People do not cherish childhood as a specifically prolonged, protected stage in the life cycle. Initiation into sex comes very early. Number six, and finally, out of all this comes a strong feeling of fatalism, helplessness, angry dependence, inferiority. Remember the song Doris Day used to sing many, many years ago, "Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be." So the poor feel every effort they make will ultimately end in failure, even though there's temporary success. So you don't utilize the opportunities that come. To offset this hopelessness, family stability also reshapes its orientation. Widespread belief in male superiority, machismo, this provides males with some sense of worth. The women are abandoned. And they, in frustration, they assert superiority in return by attempting to control the family. Families then, Lewis would argue, tend to have a more matriarchal shape to them in culture poverty. There is stability in marriage, but it's vastly different from those of other social patterns. So you have many living in common law marriage situations. Well, we could go on with this to a great extent. I think it's a topic that needs an awful lot more thinking within the missionary community. Those of us who've been overseas can see very quickly or hear very quickly in a lot of this discussion so much that makes sense. What do we do about this, though, as Christians? And specifically, how do we structure the whole task of Christian mission as it faces this question of the culture of poverty? As we've noticed already, mentioned earlier, Valentine, for example, argues that all these characteristics we've been talking about are really due to economic poverty. So the answer is to provide, then, if you're working on this basis, provide economic opportunities and wealth. Lewis's response to this, I think, is very useful. He argues that in the culture of poverty, there is a vicious cycle that breeds on itself and therefore cannot be simply broken by providing economic opportunity. What is argued, he says, what is needed is a total conversion, as it were, in the worldview of that person to get him or her out of that culture of poverty. So what is needed then for a community like this is a total structural and cultural change. And this, of course, for someone like Lewis and others, may involve a re-education of the community as a whole. And I think this is the kind of argument, for example, you're going to read when you look at Paulo Freire and his book, The Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Oscar Lewis says simply, economic aid alone does not break the vicious cycle. And I think an awful lot of people in politics today are struggling with that reality as well. In other words, these things sort of feed on themselves. In Oscar Lewis's book, The Children of Sanchez, early on, I think it's page 26 and following, he draws a little diagram, a graph on the page, a circle. And he intercepts the circle at various stages with various mentalities or moods. The circle is just that. It's a circle that comes back to itself. And I think you've got a piece of paper. Drawing that circle may give you at least a quick idea of what Lewis is talking about. At the bottom of the circle, break the circle, interrupt the circle with the word poverty. Now follow the circle along. You're going clockwise. Up there around 8 o'clock, break the circle again and put these words, high spending on food. Then around 10 o'clock on your circle, put the word distrust. Then around 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, put the word, break the circle again with the words hopelessness. Then down there on 4 o'clock, put the words failure to use opportunities. And suddenly you find yourself back in poverty and the circle goes on. I think probably in terms of a graph, you get a solid picture through that diagram, through that symbol or model of just where all of this leads itself. Now, Lewis himself offers some useful suggestions. I think that some of these may easily be incorporated into a church planting program. And I guess what we're saying is churches, and we're saying all of this because of our conviction that churches who exist in these things allegedly called cultures of poverty must minister to these needs. And we've got to wrestle to help people out of the cycle, just as we would help Christians in any other subculture to reshape and reform their culture around their new center, Jesus Christ. It seems to me that here, evangelical churches are very weak, precisely here. And one major reason, I suspect, is that we have not spent much time developing a theology of wealth and of poverty. That kind of theology needs to be developed and taught. And thankfully, some new progress has come, particularly in the last decade. But more hard work needs to be done. I put it very high on the study agenda for missions today. And that study agenda should be taught not only to the poor churches, or the churches that represent the poor, but also to the affluent, because the problem is not one-sided. In doing all this, obviously, pastor leadership is going to have to be flexible, extremely compassionate. Those of us who minister in churches that serve the poor will find long times of heavy discouragement. I'd recommend those of you who are maybe going through that, enjoying the book by Viv Grigg, G-R-I-G-E, called A Companion to the Poor, published in 1991 by World Vision by Mark, M-A-R-C, in Monrovia, California. Some rich autobiographical insights in that little volume. Something should be read late at night when you're ready to quit. What are some of the component elements that a church should bring into as it wrestles with the culture poverty, as it wrestles with working with the poor? Some of those insights you're going to find as you read, again, Viv Grigg's little essay in the back of this study guide. And in closing, all I'm going to do is just sentence by sentence remind you of crucial sort of component elements in change. Choose a research target community. An awful lot does not happen because this kind of choosing doesn't take place. Where are you going? What area will you be working with? Identify, when you do that, the responsive elements. The Holy Spirit may be working in a particular neighborhood, a slum area, among certain peoples. Think in terms, I'd say as well, of whole families. Cultures are family-oriented. You're not there to reach little kids on the street. You're not there to reach only fathers. You're not there to reach only mothers. Think in terms of whole families. Think in terms of results. Not only in just sowing seed, but watching that seed grow. Be flexible in adapting to the community. That may be particularly hard for some of us whose lifestyle has been shaped by middle class or past middle class lifestyles. Viv Grigg's book, A Companion to the Poor, will be a great help to you. Be involved in the lives of the poor. wrestle with the place of a ministry of healing in this kind of subculture. Minister to stabilize, build families, work with people, help them develop a biblical theology of wealth and poverty. The cycle must be broken. Mobilize, link to the institutions, churches in the dominant society. Look for aid that can development that can be a two-way street, where not only your churches in the poor areas are on the receiving end, they are on the giving end, and where churches more wealthy will end with churches more wealthy who can recognize that not only do they have a lot to give, they have a great deal to learn, and they will learn it best from the churches of the poor. These may be minor starts, but at least good beginnings. And we'll finish our lecture courses at this point. Thank you.